Is likability in Scotland and not being Boris in England enough to get Labour into second place in the local elections on Thursday, north of the border? We examine that and ask whether Scotland actually even has a genuinely local domain with local authorities, the largest in the developed world and almost 20 times larger than the EU average. How does that impact independence? A wee clue, disempowerment at a local level tends to stifle ambitions at a national one. We look too at Billy Kay, who got pelters for daring to use the mother tongue in a public domain, not just a private one. Those are the headlines. Now for the podcast.
Hi, chums, and welcome to this week's Leslie Riddick podcast. And you may identify by my voice that I'm marginally more cheery than I was last week, given the fact that Dundee United actually won on Saturday. And it was a great relief to all. Well, all those support Dundee United and your support Motherwell.
Let's just try and contain this a bit. But God, I don't know what it must be like to have this kind of almost bipolar problem. You know, of just kind of your fate being entirely out of your hands and dependent on these lads, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway, God love you.
Yes, it certainly is. But again, anyway, but fate being dependent, it's Thursday and the local elections. And they're despite the sort of low key, it seems to have been all ramped up this week with the series of interviews right across the media with the party leaders. And for our sins this morning, you and I listened to Keir Starmer, Ed Davey, and Anna Sarwar.
God, you listened to Ed Davey as well?
Oh, I did, yes.
Right, okay. You know. Well, let's not get this out. Can I just say before we start, because we will come to this, that it's one of the crushing aspects of Scottish politics. Mm. That we're talking about the local elections with reference to national party leaders who have a tangential input into those local domain, should have. But actually, in practice, it's all anyone's interested about. And to me, that is, I am unable. It vexes me because I feel like there's some part of my brain I haven't yet got to that would allow me to try and convey the amount to which this question of no one having interest in the local aspects of stuff and politicians and people not having confidence in the capacity of their peers right beside them and of the place that they live being less of a place than it would be elsewhere because of lack of actual ownership of land around it. All of that is Scotland's plight. So I feel a terrible responsibility because I feel like a door swung open. I've seen something, understood it, and it shuts again. And I seem to not be able to convey strongly enough how much this matters. But then that's always the way when a sort of aspect of life has gone. It's not something that people focus on. And local government has gone in Scotland. There is no local government. I mean, possibly give you an exception of Orkney, Shetland and the Western Isles, but even the Western Isles, 2 days by ferry, 3 days, you know, potentially to reach your local headquarters. It's a nonsense. Anyway, we'll come back to that potentially. But so meanwhile, on the kind of national front by which people will end up using, people will use the kind of their ideas about national leaders because it's not clear to them what other issues in, especially in Scotland, in regional councils, so large, no one knows a councillor pretty much. Well, how else would you divvy them up? So it's not surprising that we end up with this, I would put this more strongly, but, you know, round the wrong way kind of approach to local politics. Anyway, Keir Starmer on the Today programme, dearie me, I mean, really, I think this is quite important as well at a sort of, you know, at a kind of national and indie level, because this man is not going to win an election. He's just not, unless, you know, Boris hangs on and is kind of half wounded and some successor is even worse. But by gum, he's just, you know, he cannot answer a question. He just can't do it. It's extraordinary and it's irritating. I mean, I remember podcasts you and I did, Pat, when he was God, you know, I can't even remember what he was before, and the Corbyn, but he stood in for Corbyn quite a few times.
Yes.
And I remember one particular one, listening to him and thinking, by gum, this guy's good. You know, I think we agreed he was,
yes,
you know. But now when he sounds pompous, he talks about himself all the time in a way that maybe this is just my upbringing, but, you know, using the word I've done this with the Labour Party under my leadership. It just sounds like a little stampy footy 4-year-old that just isn't getting enough attention. And I did this and my thing with that, because someone's told him that he needs to look like a leader. You know, look at, you know, Volodymyr Zelensky. I'm not sure, and I know this might be unfortunate comparisons, but in terms of what we see an awful lot of currently, I'm not sure how much he goes on about under my leadership we have. You know, it's just, that's, if you've got to get to the point that you have to kind of badge your leadership as being kind of there and impressive, you've kind of lost.
Yeah.
You know, so there's that, which just puts my hackles up to start with. And then it's just not being able to answer a question. I mean, he was asked a direct question about whether the Durham police had got in touch with him recently over the Beergate allegations that the Daily Mail and others have been going on about. And instead of saying no, he just said, you know, this is a ridiculous thing. It's being trumped up by the Tories. You know, I mean, the thing is, and then he's ending up using the same phrasing that Boris used when he lied.
Yeah.
When he said all the rules were complied with. And you think, do you not hear how that's just walked into the last time we heard someone saying that was Boris Johnson, who lied. You know, so don't use the phrase even. It's toxic. You can't use that. What you have to do is answer the blasted question. And I mean, there was other things earlier when he was asked about, you know, what he would do for, you know, what did he stand for? And he said, we will, you know, people don't know what you stand for. And this was something that Alistair Campbell has tossed mm-hmm. in the arena. And he says, it's not that. It's what will we do for your energy bills?
Yes.
Well, that's not, you see, that's not what you were asked. And, you know, we've got, the interviewer, you know, calmly explained she'd already given him 10 minutes on what they do about energy bills. So that wasn't what she'd asked him. It was what he stood for. And he just repeated it. He said, it's what we'll do for your energy bills. They like it on the doorstep. Now, see, mm-hmm. if that's true, that's one you keep inside your head. Because when you put it outside your head, it makes you sound like a naked opportunist.
Yes.
You know, that basically we've just permed what people like to hear on the doorsteps, and that's what we stand for. And actually, that came to me right with his parting thing. I mean, he was asked, would he think about common ownership again? He said the immediate problem is to deal with bills, not what you are asked. So she asks again, nationalisation? I don't think that's the answer to the current crisis. Honestly, my mind started thinking, do you know something? Just for sheer cheek, the SNP should stand candidates in England. You know, because, OK, I'm not saying they're the left, most left-wing folk in the universe, but they have that perception. And they could probably clean up quite a lot of votes, you know, down the road. And if they actually won a couple of MPs, it might help in come the day in Westminster. But actually, we've had enough blooming preoccupation with Westminster, so it's not an idea. But it's that bad.
Yeah.
It's that bad that you start thinking, blooming, I could go down and do this, or somebody could do it. And then you have to resist it because it's their problem. And his parting shot, you know, when he was asked, why should anyone vote for you? Essentially, he said, because I'm utterly focused on winning elections.
Yeah.
Again, inside your head, matey. You know, nobody is impressed with people who, well, perhaps a very, very tiny, you know, minority of people are impressed with those who simply are instrumental, you know, who only want power. It's not attractive, you know. So I thought it was absolutely shocking, actually, as an interview, and shifty and,
yeah,
you know, all the things I remember are the things he didn't answer. And there was a point where he also has got these little tropes that he has to feed in. So, you know, somebody said to him, you know, obviously all the polls suggest that Labour under Corbyn was seen as being unpatriotic by the red wall voters. So he now has to sound patriotic. Even if he's on the radio, he has to sound like he's wearing a Union Jack outfit, you know. So, he was talking about foreign policy and, you know, he was talking about people have really noticed our unshakable support for NATO. And see, that's it. You can't say the word NATO. It has to come unshakable support for NATO. And he's got these drop in little tropes that go everywhere just in case you didn't get it. And the trouble for a lawyer who depends on language and argument is you depend far too much on words and pernickety choice of words and all this sort of thing, and don't answer in case they come back with that. One day you just have to say something that you actually mean, and you also have to just ooze what you have to be what you're talking about. And I think there's just too much of a kind of brick wall around him, and too much of a I am just not Corbyn. That's all this is about.
Yeah. I mean, he got himself elected on a left of centre progressive agenda within the Labour Party, and he basically jettisoned all of it. And I mean, and just looking at, I know Twitter is a kind of echo chamber, but I follow a lot of socialists and Labour Party members on Twitter down in England, and they are not at all happy with the way Starmer got himself elected. And it seems absolutely clear to me that he's not smart enough, like Blair was, and I'll give Blair this incredible communicator, he's not smart enough like Blair to actually sound authentic and sincere whilst operating within the framework of what do the focus group say we should be taking a stance on this. He's just not good enough at it. Mm. I mean, Ed Davey, God love him, actually sounded a lot more authentic and gave, he was clearer, he's more communicative, and gave a much better interview on Radio 4 earlier. You know, and I've got no time for Ed Davey either, to be honest about it. But when the choice down south is, you know, how you're going to vote, and again, because they're operating, people
first
may not realise.
First past the post, unbelievably. I mean, good grief, yeah. Sorry.
No. I mean, it is that whole thing. But I mean, I listened to Anna Sarwar on Good Morning Scotland, and there were a couple of things that came out about it. I mean, he's definitely ploughing the line of we want everybody to come home to Labour. But his big thing was, and I was quite taken aback by this, I don't know what your reaction is, because Labour is now more, wait for it, likeable. We're likeable. Yeah. Which is, I thought, hang on a minute here. And again, he again focused on national issues rather than taking a look at what these elections ought to be about. But your point is entirely correct. These are like they're surrogate national elections in England. And in addition to that, up here, the surrogate referendum. That's what they are. And it's we are caught in that trap. He also said that it's the Tories to blame and it's the SNP to blame, which just comes as very interesting, because when you actually get down to Wales, where there are local elections, it's nothing at all to do with the failures of the Welsh government within the devolution settlement. It's all to do with the Tories. But we get where they're going there. He also talked about no formal coalitions. But what he did say, they would operate on an issue-by-issue basis. And he was confronted with the fact, I believe it's North Renfrewshire has been identified as the best-operated local authority, maybe in the UK, but definitely in Scotland. And that is an SNP-Labour coalition. But no, we're not going to go for coalitions. We're going to stand apart and operate on an issue-by-issue basis. He was tackled on Radio 4, which is a very interesting one. The difference between on Good Morning Scotland, he was tackled in a very different way. I mean, he was asked about the fact about Labour's windfall tax. And it was suggested to him that as BP had made a massive loss just this last three quarters, I think it was about 20 billion, was the Labour Party's windfall tax, you know, now dead in the water. And he suggested, it should be done on last year's figures. And I compared that to what happened on Radio 4, who actually give a very in-depth analysis of where BP's loss was. They actually made an underlying profit of $6.2 billion mm-hmm. compared to $2 billion last year. And the reason why they've made this one-off loss is they've divested from the Russian Rosneft, the Russian massive energy company. They've flogged their shares off on it. So this is a one-off. He didn't pick up on that, which surprised me, you know, on that. And I also took a look at the different ways this was tackled between Radio 4, who are very clear on the underlying profit on the Today programme, whereas Radio Scotland went for the simple let's get Sarwar one. But again, he's very plausible. He emphasised his membership, the GMB union. You know, he's plausible. He talked about going for second place, which is the limit of their ambitions, to be perfectly frank.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, this is also something that came up in an earlier interview with John Curtis, who was analysing the whole shooting match and was observing about Scotland that the unionists are now extremely divided in a mm-hmm. way that independentistas, or however you would call it, shrugged us all into nationalists,
yeah.
are not. And actually, I think I might end up writing something about this tomorrow for the National on Thursday, because this is, I mean, that was a sort of, you know, small point, but it's actually it's a pretty big point, because, I mean, yeah, well, kind of obviously the unionists are divided. You know, they're the legacy of better together.
Yes.
That's it. So, you know, and this is also explains Anna Sarwar's stuff about this nonsense stuff about no coalitions, because he's been told from somewhere on high, we need clear blue water between us and the Tories on everything now. This is another one of, you know, doubtless this is another one of Keir Starmer's ones, along with she looks up the trope unshakable support for NATO is, you know, there's yeah. no, we are totally different from the Tories, except we don't do nationalisation. We don't want to talk about common yeah. ownership and bloody, bloody, blinking, blah. So if you've got to look like this clear blue water, the most troubling kind of a clear unionist water, most troubling area are these local compacts, which allow, you know, which does what a blooming Labour first minister intended it to do when he yes. introduced STV for these elections. And as you say, produce pretty stable government. Now, you know, nobody would think that going issue by issue is any kind of basis for running any sort of anything, but particularly not local government, you know, which is just, that's just not the way that's ever going to work. So I imagine all that happens here is these are words, you know, nobody's yeah. going to police this and sort of go, hang on a minute, have you guys secretly got some sort of coalition? They're just going to have to try and conceal the fact that they cooperate.
Yeah.
And I couldn't find a worse kind of contrast than where we are with, with kind of we had a Nordic Horizons event, which was looking at the Faroes and Norway, which are just examples of normal. You know, it's not that they're exceptional. They're our nearest neighbours, both of them, and they're normal in terms of the size of their local democracy, albeit the Faroes is probably on the small end of normal. yeah. We had a brilliant guy, Dennis Holm, and there's a podcast with all this in it, by the way, which we'll put the link up to. But you can listen to this podcast. And honestly, if you're not biting the table at the end of it, then I don't know. But Dennis was mayor for 6 years of a small town called Vágar on an island called Suðuroy, which is the southernmost of the 18 Faroes Islands. It's the only one that doesn't yet have a tunnel, because it's a 2-hour journey by ferry to the capital, Tórshavn. Yet it is about to open the tunnel to Tórshavn later this year, which, I mean, again, it's just such mm-hmm. a tribute to a little country, the Faroes, with 55,000 people in it and its own university, which he is a lecturer in. Anyway, so his little town of Vágar, they had this brilliant swimming champion, Paul. And he won a European championship in 2010, a silver medal. And the commentator said somebody should build this guy a 50-metre pool, because he'd always trained in a 25-metre pool on the island of Suðuroy, which has 4,000 people on it. And I'm trying to think of what, you know, I was trying often to think of parallel islands.
Yeah. But
the funny thing is that they have more, and I find this true of Norway as well, that actually similar sized physical islands have got infinitely more people. Mm-hmm. They're all more populated as a long-term result of this very thing we're talking about. So anyway, 4,000 people on the island, 1,300 people in Vágar. So I don't know, that is pretty small, isn't it? Is that Wormit?
Well, Wormit in Newport, I reckon, yeah, probably.
Yeah, so Wormit in Newport, perhaps. So they had this 25-metre pool. This off-the-cuff remark was made that, you know, this champion deserved a 50-metre pool to train in. So they said, yeah, let's just do that then. So they got a land pretty much given to them by a local businessman. They then used a lot of sweat labour from the fishermen. That wasn't much of a time off for them when they came back from their, you know, fishing trips. Yusuf, you see the pictures, the women from the area we're in later painting the sort of colour of the things and the stripes along the swimming pool lanes. I mean, they completed an Olympic standard 50 metre pool. Obviously, they had, you know, professional contractors for some of it, but they did it all in 4 years flat from thinking about it for a quarter of the price that it would have been if they'd built the whole thing. And the pictures, when you see the opening thing with Paul, I wish I could, I haven't got his surname in front of me, in the pool, who by this stage had won pretty much medals all over the place, you know, so he is their guy. It's fantastic. And it buoyed them up so much that they decided, OK, they would now go on and build a sports high school. So this, again, just remember, 1,300 people now has a sports high school with 48 boarding places because people from other places in the Faroes want to come to this place that focuses entirely. Well, you know, it does all its academic stuff, but it's very much a sports high school, which I think Scotland has, actually. I seem to remember, you know, Douglas Academy guy being at a music high school, and there's doubtless, you know, other concentrations.
Well, there's, there's football academies as well.
I think none of them are as small as 1,300 people, you know. So this is the kind of ambition these guys, and the reason they're able to do that is, and many more things besides, you know, they've got all sorts of projects on the go, and they have they decided to change because they realised that their population was sliding constantly for the last 70 years, as the position that they occupied, which was the closest to the fishing grounds, became essentially not an advantage at all, as fishing began to slip as a kind of as an employer, and their distance from their own HQ, Torshavn, became the biggest problem for them. And people were sloping off to go to secondary school or to go to university and never coming back. So what Dennis is very strong on, and this he thinks is true for every remote and rural area in the North Atlantic, is that there's a change happening where people are moving out of cities, especially after COVID. They want more control of their time. They want access to nature. They want better environments to live in. They want different lives. And all of that's a draw potentially for wee places like Vágar, if you can try to summon your own folk to come back. So their emphasis is on having an experience economy, which sounds a bit kind of, you know, jargony, kind of Keir Starmer sort of thing there. But what they mean is, if you have a good memory as a child of what you had, when you're at the stage of having families yourself, the only place you want to be is back home.
Yeah.
So all the stuff that they're creating, and you see the pictures of the kids, you know, whether it's swimming, whether it's on the only indoor climbing wall in the Faroes, whether, you know, it's in the netball tournament that they set up, which ended up doubling their population for 4 days, whether it's all their friends coming because their tourist accommodation has increased 485% in the years that Dennis was mayor, because people want to come in, they bring their families, they bring, you know, all of this has made Vágar a hub, which is probably what's justified building the tunnel. So all of this is about trying to make sure that what your childhood was like was so blooming good that you would want to come back. And then, of course, it's possible for you to build a house without breaking the bank, because nobody but the Scots has got the remnants of the feudal land ownership that mean that it's impossible here. And you've got control. You've got control over your local area. And the point that almost broke my heart was when someone asked a very reasonable question about the small municipalities, saying, you know, is there a lot of competition for the skilled staff you need to be able to run things? And there was just a pause before Dennis basically said, there's a lot of skill in people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. There's no, you know, the Scots are always thinking there's some, you know, gifted, rare people out there that you have to sort of fight to get and put them in charge of as much as possible, because that way all the little people who could make mistakes and mess everything up, they don't get their head. You know, they don't get to be able to mess things up, because the big beak, the big brain, you know, actually this could be a character in a new Doctor Who series, a brain this big. This massive brain that you're going to pay 200,000 quid for, not enough. Let's give them a bonus. That person is the only one who can run stuff. And this is, everybody else thinks that's rubbish. And what they do, I mean, in Norway, because we had the Norwegian local government minister on, they're educate in their little municipalities. The head of education is a teacher, part-time teacher.
That'll never catch on.
You know, nice, isn't it? Because, you know, all problems are very quickly dealt with. And similarly with the old folks home, the old folks home worker is also the head of the, is up and running the old folks stuff for the local council. They collaborate and cooperate. This is me finally coming back to my point. Thank you. With Anna Sarbar and the don't cooperate thing. They cooperate across the small municipalities, which leads everyone to say, well, why don't you just, join up? But that's not how it works, because there are seven councils on this little island of Suðuroy of 4,000 people, seven councils. One has just 80 people. They have three councillors. They have to wait till they all come back from fishing at the same time to have a meeting, albeit they could use the broadband that there's excellent.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
So the thing is, they keep political control over what they're doing, and they make decisions about how things will run. And their income, they get 20% of income tax. There's
That's
none of this
parting
about
yeah.
with different, mechanisms and stuff like that. There's a 40 to 45% income tax across all the Nordics, and it's just instantly divvied up, and 20% goes to the local municipality. So that little council of 80 people, I wish I could remember, had a budget of €3 million.
Right.
And if you're not spending it on a £200,000 director of education, and you're not spending it paying councillors, although that's a relatively small item, but in Norway it's the same. You don't pay councillors because your councils are so small, they can have meetings in the evening and walk home generally. as opposed to the day long drives, and once you take the islands in and ferries, you've got the potential, as the Western Isles councillors have, to be away from home for a week simply to have attended a meeting in Stornoway. So the thing is, we are so off beam with this, and yet nobody cares. And I know no one cares. I know that possibly people will have really sped over this bit of the podcast.
Yeah.
And yet this is what's crippling us. This
yes,
is why
absolutely.
We haven't got a yes vote. This is why we haven't got people confident about independence, because independence is in your attitude. It's you. The Norwegians even passed a law back in the 1820s enshrining self-government into their constitution. Self-government, and this was before independence, meaning that the municipalities could not be governed by Oslo.
Yeah.
So I really think we need to get our heads around this. I know we're here like blooming sheep now. We are like sheep. We have to stand in line, keep voting SNP or Green or ALBA or whatever, but basically keep toeing the line until we get to the evidence of whether or not we've got a referendum next year. But there's so much wrong with our status quo that is hobbling us. And there's going to be a point where we have to fix this. We can't keep going on just saying that, the distant prospect of independence is always what means that the proper systems that would allow us. And I mean, this is the thing that really struck me about both these guys, Dennis and Ola from Norway, is just that they were incredulous when I gave them our statistics. They're at, Norwegian average, 10,000 people per council. Our average, 170,000 people per council. And, they just said, you're not harnessing the potential of your people. And we're not. There's a tiny cohort. It's so British. There's a tiny elitist cohort who are allowed to run everything. And from their say-so, money rains down conditionally upon the little people, which are in such large units, however, that basically no one feels any connection. And if you want to really save your community, you go out with the entire formal political process and do a community buyout.
Yeah.
So anyway, I mean, I think I'm just, thank you for letting me get that off my chest.
Yes, that's going to be, yeah. And in the words of, what was my fifth, ego te absolvo, that's thou art forgiven. No, it's absolutely right, Liz, because when I was reading the article, and it's something we've talked about before, in the sense of if you give people local control at a local level, it develops independence, it develops a way we can do this ourselves. And what we've got is the SNP, I think, have missed the trick in their desire to centralise and control. by giving independence to local authorities and by creating smaller local authorities, you create that independence of thought, that independence of spirit that would then translate into, well, if we can do this at this level, we can do it at that level. And they've missed it in the desire to control. And what we've got as well is, you said, a 46% turnout predicted, the lowest number of candidates, and look at the number of no contests. It's scandalous.
It is, and yet it'll just be shrugged off. That will not, nobody, you know, even the Herald, actually what prompted me to even go focused on this was that the Herald's editorial had described, if there was a higher than 46% turnout, it would be gratifying.
Yeah.
Because 46% was the highest ever, you know, on record recently. And that's not ever, because, you know, there was a friskier turnout when we had far more councils, and it would take too long to go into the whole history of how this has been done. But a very interesting point was raised in the podcast by Andy Whiteman and by Professor John Bryden, who is Scottish but now lives in Denmark, about the fact that a report in the 1960s basically reduced Scotland to these huge unitary authorities in a way that was not done south of the border. So in fact, you know, I'm trying to unravel that myself a bit now to just get the history of this right, and it's absolutely fascinating. My thinking is, surprisingly, that a lot of this stems from the Second World War, when there was a command economy, when we came out of it and went into nationalisation. And at that point, a lot of powers, which some of us who are old enough will remember, were local powers. I remember in Belfast, the Belfast City Council gasworks. Councils provided energy. Councils ran hospitals. Councils ran all sorts of functions which were souped up or given to quangos or privatised. But one piece that I was reading speculated that the capacity to have, you know, essentially and inadvertently, the kind of foot hills of privatisation were created by a Labour government that nationalised and took things, essentially centralised and nationalised. Yeah. In Scotland, I mean, Britain, you have to make that qualification. If you read or listen to the guys in the Faroes and Norway, they talk about centralisation or nationalisation very disparagingly for actually left of centre countries, really, that have got fairly strong ownership of national assets. Because nationalisation is ownership by Oslo, whereas they do have public ownership. It's just that public ownership is owning by the municipalities.
Yes.
So the hydro energy that transformed Norway, all the hydros are owned by the municipalities. They never got that never got sucked back off to Oslo, because these peasants that made up the peasants' parliament were clever enough to kick the log into the door to make sure that one never slammed. And it's constitutionally impossible for them. So, I mean, really, when you start to get your heads around this, it really shows you we are. I know we could have arguments about this, and it might well be there are some services which are better run at a sort of national level, but I don't think they're anything like the ones that we believe in. And in fact, let's ask questions. The National Health Service, which was a council-run thing, the aim of the NHS was to standardise care and various things like that. Has that happened?
Mm-hmm.
You know, has even having a National Health Service resulted in uniform care across the whole of Britain or Scotland? I'm not sure that it has. I'm not sure that actually properly run councils wouldn't be producing just as good a result if they had what they have, which is guaranteed 20% of income tax.
Mm-hmm.
And if anyone's doubtful about that, I would ask yourself, why do you doubt that? And you only doubt that because you think there are seven people in Edinburgh who are the only folk who can run anything. And if you think that, why are we bothering with independence, really?
I mean, I always have been a massive fan of municipal socialism and workers' ownership and cooperatives. And I remember going back years when I still had the starry-eyed approach to nationalisation, talking to miners in Fife. And I asked this old miner who'd been working when the nationalisation took place after World War II. I says, "What changed? What changed?" And he says, "Aye, laddie, the name." That was it. It was the National Coal Board. That's all that changed for the workers in that industry. That's the, they felt no effect at all whatsoever. And giving people control and handing it back to them. And I think one of the key things, if socialism meant state control, that would mean the army, the police, the judges. I mean, that's all aspects of socialism, and we know it isn't. But yeah, it's...
But then when you look at something like Sweden, I mean, a lot of people, the Americans particularly, Eisenhower just, you know, dismissed Sweden as a sort of mad socialist state in the aftermath of the Second World War, because they were so successfully operating a different way of you know, different sort of economy. But I mean, the Swedes, you know, the average Swede doesn't pay any income tax to central government. They pay all their income tax to their local government, because that's where they get all their services from. And central government is funded by higher rate taxpayers and corporation tax. So it's kind of like, it takes quite a long reorientation. And personally speaking, I've been through that process for the last 10 years with all the Nordic stuff. And it just slowly settles on you again that this is what being boiled, the boiled frog is about.
Yeah.
Is that all we can see are small increments of a basically disempowering system, which, of course, on the doorsteps, let's get back to the sacred doorsteps. And I mean, I'm not making light of that. A democracy is full of candidates who need to be elected. So you're not going to win any votes standing trying to have a long conversation about empowerment and the size of local authorities on a doorstep. I quite get that. But do you know, that's the idea of politics is about, for Scotland in particular, again, as I think the Norwegian minister said, you have had a brutal history. I mean, it's something to hear it from somebody else.
Yeah.
And, you know, a brutalized child needs careful work and patience, but to pull them away from what would be their otherwise their path. And actually, Scotland needs pulling away from this path that just keeps compounding errors, essentially. And that has to happen sometime. You know, we can't keep putting this off forever. So roll on after the elections, because as I understand it, there's going to be some announcement, although, you know, we've all learned not to hold our breath on these ones regarding the referendum. Except that, you know, the likeliest thing is that we will steam ahead with a referendum. It'll go to the Supreme Court. It'll get knocked down, and that'll be the end of it. You know, so, you know. But anyway,
I'm going to pick up on that. Just a last little bit there about it going to the Supreme Court. Andrew Marr spoke to Michael Gove, and Michael Gove is minded not to let it go to the Supreme Court, because he thinks that would be a rhetorical win for the SNP, if it had to go to the Supreme Court and look at these big boys down south, unelected judges, you know, turning down the democratic right of the Scottish people to have a referendum. So it's
How does he plan to not let it go to the Supreme Court, and that not to seem even more tackety boots?
Well, but he's just gonna say no. I think that's the tactic, as far as I can identify.
I don't think you get to say no. I mean, if the Scottish government, you know, if the Scottish government persist in producing a referendum bill, I mean, the point will be, and I think there's, you know, I wish I'd cranked my brain up properly on this one, but, you know, on some of these powers that are potentially contested, they could say it's just not contested, you haven't got the power. Mm-hmm. But there must be some mechanism. I mean, they're just going to keep going. So actually, I can't see how anything Gove says is not going to stop Scottish government preparing a referendum bill and continuing through it with all its different parts of the passage. If he can say that it doesn't get to go to the Supreme Court for adjudication as to whether or not there's competence in Scotland to do it, I think that's a probably worse outcome than the judges smacking it down.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, because what they'll turn around and say is it's illegal. And then what you would get, that whole point with the unionist parties, if you refuse to take part in it and thus undermine its legitimacy if the Scottish government went ahead with it. And we know how much, quite rightly, I think, the Scottish government and the SNP actually believe there should be an internationally recognised legitimate referendum.
Yeah, that's true. But that's, I mean, with all respect, and I mean, who knows what they'll come up with. But illegal, you know, that's the thing that, you know, we have a Supreme Court to decide.
Yeah.
So I think this is still perilous stuff for them, because as with all of this, I mean, there's plenty Tories who would concede I mean, I keep quoting Andy McIver, but, you know, doubtless others, that there is well over a mandate to have a second independence referendum. There just is, you know, and that the easiest thing to do, the fairest thing to do now to be able to move on at all as a country is to have it. Now, you know, that doesn't mean they want to vote yes, but they're probably the point of saying that there's enough mandate for a referendum. You know, there probably is over 50% for that.
Yes.
So that's the one that the SNP have stuck to up till now. Some of us would like them to have actually, you know, had a bit of visionary stuff about the destination. But up till now, they've stuck to the kind of there's a mandate here. Democracy means we should be able to have a vote. Now, if they really want to come in and kind of say, you just don't even get, you know, it's illegal for you to even think about this, and we're not even going to allow the normal mechanisms of the Supreme Court to decide that, you just can't do it. I suspect there'll be quite a number of Tories and middle of the road people who just don't like this kind of making it up as you go along approach from Westminster, setting up a parliament which they then undermine at every turn. That will, I think, cause a lot of people anxiety, because essentially then you've just got a kind of totemic figurehead of a Scottish parliament that could go so far and no further on many things. And I suspect that's just going to be a really bad move. I don't think this is a doddle for any of them. No. And I think Andrew's analysis kind of, you know, he wrote in the rest of his New Statesman thing about how Trident was going to be the thing that would stop her independence. And I suspect from a London point of view, and sorry, I wasn't meaning that to sound awfully catty, but, you know, if you're not been living here for a long time, you see one side of that argument and you see it on paper for sure. There's been a different approach to, I mean, here we're talking about arming Ukraine, and probably many of us are sort of pacifists, really, you know.
Yes.
So there's definitely Ukraine has changed things and has then changed NATO. I mean, we're hearing Finland and Sweden now really gearing up to join NATO, which they had constitutional bars on up till now. So there's no denying that things have changed. However, there's another side to all of this, which is that, you know, the presence of Trident in Scotland has actually been a recruiting sergeant for independence. And there's no greater example of that than Nicola Sturgeon, who joined CND before she joined the SNP. And many of us, aghast at being the sort of dustbin for everything, whether it's, you know, Dounreay, you know, whatever thing was going to be put at an extreme away from populations that might be serious and not, you know, just a Mickey Mouse Scottish Glasgow. We see that. And we also see what happened in the Iraq war when, you know, Britain was just an American poodle to be deployed at the behest of an American president we had no control over, who also controls the actual weaponry on the Trident submarines. So, you know, if you think that's all OK, then you're not living here, because 70% of Scots look at that as a sort of deal and just think, don't think so. Yeah. And whether or not that then results in there being a problem for Britain housing that nuclear deterrent, because there's no other good place to put it, that is sort of a problem for Britain. But I don't think it's much of a stumbling block. I think this, you know, that's not really, I think, sitting uppermost in people's minds about Scottish independence, actually. So I think that's just a debating point that he was able to pick up and run with, you know. Yeah. But no, that's all a bit off beam, I think.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I thought it interesting that he quoted the MOD study, and this actually displayed Marr's Anglo-centric perspective on this, I think, where he said that the rejected sites in South Wales, because it was too near oil and gas installations, and rejected the south of England, particularly Plymouth, because it was too near largely populated areas. Well, if anyone has looked at the map, if there was a nuclear strike on Faz Lane, I think when you wipe out significant elements right across Scotland, you know, I think it's we're the largely populated area. And if we do become independent, that's the rest of the UK's issue where they put Trident, not ours.
Yeah, actually, I think that was also quoting a study done by an academic, which I remember editing when I was assistant editor of The Scotsman, which shows you how long this has been sitting as an issue, because nobody, I had a wee column in The Scotsman called Off the Spike, which was basically
Yeah.
This is like the old days when you used to get physical copy that would come chuntering out of machines, different colours for all the different agencies. And a copy taster's job, I used to love it, was to walk along those printers and tearing off the stories, reading them. Mm-hmm. And if you thought they were a pile of mints, they went on a physical spike. So a story being spiked literally was on the spike. And there was a stage where I went through when I was, promoted to assistant editor, I actually took the spike into my office and just sat, unspiked everything, and read through these fascinating stories that were all hitting the bucket immediately. And so I sort of thought, God almighty, there's more interesting stuff here than we're actually printing. So I was, had the argument, was given this little kind of column off the spike. And that was an off the spike column, which must have been, in the late 1990s, the work that guy did, looking at every other possible place to put Trident and finding them all problematic. So it's been there for a very long time, that reality. It's just that the reality of impending independence hasn't sharpened minds. But there will have to be all sorts of compromises. And you think actually when they get to that, all the opinion polls, and it'll be interesting to see if they have shifted in England actually as a result of Ukraine, but all the opinion polls were at 70% of the entire British population do not want the renewal of Trident. And that was before Ukraine, I'll give you that.
Yeah.
But I still think that any UK government trying to kind of, make that a massive issue would strike at this always ignored majority for actually losing weapons of mass destruction anyway. So, and of course, in having said that, this now rules me out as ever being able to join the Labour Party under Keir Starmer.
Yes.
Since it looks like there's 11 MPs that there's still a call to kind of get rid of because they signed a letter questioning NATO, membership. Anyway.
Yeah. Well, talking about off the spike, which you kind of take a little left turn before I come back to something else, is what do you make of the BBC's lack of coverage of the National Crime Agency's raid on, Baroness Moon, Michelle Moon's house over the PPE Medpro scandal, which folk might recall was the fact that someone who actually was Anthony Page, I believe it was, who literally on the same day that left Moon's company, MGM Media, set up this PPE company. They bought, 25 million gowns from China for £46 million, then immediately sold them to the UK government for £122 million, £76 million of profit they made a middleman, and they were rejected, never used, and she denied entirely the fact that she had anything to do with it, and now texts have been revealed that she was tweeting, texting to people to secure the VIP lane for this person who literally founded the company on the day that he left Michelle Moon's company. It's, other than a five-minute piece on Good Morning Scotland where they talked about to Julian Moon of the Good Law Project, about the case that they were taking, but it didn't refer to Michelle Moon specifically about the scandal of the contracts that were issued. It's a complete non-story. I just don't understand it.
Yeah, well, yes. I mean, anything that I'm not defending them or can't really think through my head on that way, because I mean, it's clearly newsworthy. It's of interest to people since Michelle Moon. I mean, I see they covered her comments on Bitcoin or something like that, which is like a complete non-story.
Yes.
So how that can be worthy of coverage and then not this rather major thing. Now, maybe the problem with this is that no arrests have been made.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know if, sometimes there's a thing where they're not sure if there's going to be charges pending. But it's possible that, it's kind of like, it's a bit like the Keir Starmer thing. Apparently the pollist did actually get in touch with him at the beginning of the Beergate thing. He said in that interview in the Today programme. That's not, however, what he was asked by the questioner. She asked, have they recently, since the Tories have really gone for you, have they revisited you? And that he wouldn't answer. So the difficulty is when there's been an action taken, but there's no outcome to it yet, as I think there isn't an outcome, is there?
Mm-hmm. No.
Yeah. So it's messy, but I'm guessing that, they're waiting to go the extra mile when there's some actual outcome to the whole thing. And so many people get away with this, when there's investigations made and And that is something that people are not too sure about commenting on, because then you absolutely, if the investigations went the other way and there was nothing, no further action taken, and they were essentially in the clear, you know, potentially if you weren't very careful, you would have libeled somebody. So I don't think that's much of an answer on this one. But, you know, this is given that they just really don't want to get involved in anything to do with Tory peers, this is just going to kick in pretty quickly as a kind of, I would say, convenient excuse. But it's also, you know, if you look at the BBC, they basically follow the papers when it comes to personal attacks and stuff. You know, it's all basically, they don't lower themselves to do personal stuff much until the papers are full of it, and then they'll end up putting it in paper reviews. So the question is also why there's no paper that's really running with this except the National.
Yeah, well, also, they may have been burned by the Cliff Richard episode, if we were to call about the raid on his house, which may be which should be at the front of their minds. You said earlier you had your hobby horse about the Nordics, and here we gang. This is Aberdeen Ken's my hobby horse, and it's the Scots language. I would like to say I was utterly astounded by the absolute vitriol in social media, and from Lord George Foulkes, in particular from politicians, about Billy's speech to Holyrood, which he gave in Scots, and he was meticulous in his reference to people right across the political spectrum who'd actually used and supported the use of the Scots language. And what you've got is like the Gaelic beforehand. There's a growing mythology that they're an essence of the Scots language, and interest in it is all to do with the SNP and the drive towards independence. And for George Foulkes, what took me aback completely was the fact he seemed to forget, well, for whatever reason, he was part of the Tony Blair government in 2001 that ratified the European Charter for Regional Minority Language, and give official status to the Scots language, along with Gaelic, Welsh, Manx, Cornish, Irish and Ulster Scots in Northern Ireland. And the talk, and this harks back to what happened in 2014 with another couple of dodes, you know, Dode Robertson saying the Catalonians have language and culture, we don't have any of that. And Galloway saying there's no such thing as a distinct Scottish culture. And it actually flummoxes me why that they're going so strongly against the Scots language, particularly politicians. I can get it from those who are of a North British persuasion on social media. And the other thing that gets me as well is, and Foulkes did it, was he differentiated between Doric, which is a dialect of the Scots language, and the other Scots tongues, such as Lallans or, heaven forfend, Dundonian. It seems like a class thing to me as well, you know. And there's a linguistic talk about a thing called linguistic imperialism. Mm-hmm. And I'll give people the benefit to listen to what the hallmarks of linguistic imperialism are and see if they apply to Scots. It favours the dominant language over another. More resources and infrastructure are given the dominant language. It encourages beliefs that the dominant language form is more prestigious than others. They've naturalized that idea. This becomes normal. It causes injustice and inequality between those who use the dominant language and those who do not. And learning the dominant language is at the expense of others. And what we see with Scots is what the unionists have done with being anti-Gaelic in the past. And it is part of that culture war that's going on. And it takes me aback that such an essential part of our heritage and our culture and the parts of Scotland that spoke Scots, that it should be denigrated, denied and turned into a political weapon. And hell mend them if it does become a political weapon, you know, hell mend them. And they're taking away that element because of the fear of Scottish independence, of the beauty and the nature of the Scots language. So it's what Billy came through it very, very well. But the vitriol, as I said before, that was expressed towards him, was I thought, yeah, I can expect that, but it was still very disheartening to see.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think this is absolutely, as you say, the linguistic imperialism is that it's essential for unionism to have no borders, to have same populations that, generally speaking, don't really vote differently, just have to overlook the voting history of the last 100 years. But that voting history can feel a very sort of stale, you know, thing. Mm-hmm. Sometimes if you don't animate that political realm, the thing that really attaches to people is cultural stuff. That's what's closest to them. Now, it's fine enough if culture remains a private thing, and the Scots language is sometimes quite a private thing.
Yeah.
I mean, you started talking there in Dundonian, and I'm conscious of this continually, that because I can't speak back to you in Dundonian because I don't come from Dundee, you lapse back into English, essentially, yeah. You know. And this is what generally is true in the public realm, that when, and it's true with Gaelic speakers, I mean, many people have despaired about that when there's one English speaker in the group, everyone will default to English. I sometimes wonder about other languages abroad even, because that's happening across mm-hmm. the world. So that doesn't, however, diminish the force of connection that's created in the private, intimate zone by using your own tongue. It isn't diminished at all by the fact that it very often doesn't make the leap into the public realm. It's still going strong there pretty much everywhere. And folk who think that just because they don't hear many Billy Kay addresses, there's no Scots spoken in Scotland, mm-hmm. are just totally wrong. But the point of what Billy did there was he took that private language into a public realm. He was in a kind of lauded, high-held public moment there, and he was using a private language that demonstrates Scotland's different history and continuing difference, because people could understand him. So all of that, I think, is where a lot of the vitriol comes from, is because Billy puts his head over the parapet and is in and was asked. So you know, the both ends of that are basically almost breaking the gentleman's agreement, which are, you can have your little poxy Scots language as long as you didn't bring it in to any kind of, you know, posh venue. And that is a great moment, actually, because there should be more people speaking the way they would normally speak. But of course, all of us tend to kind of, as it were, default into the tidying up your language when you're in a public zone thing. So it takes a lot of confidence and courage, actually, to be able to bring your private world into a public domain and believe that it deserves to be there, and know that the bulk of people listening will either understand you completely or simply be intrigued by the bits they didn't get, and might maybe even go away and have a wee shifty and learn a little about what, you know, is part of our canon. So yeah, it was a good one, but it just demonstrates absolutely that language is a very important thing, obviously, and culture is a very important thing for independence. And again, it's one that I think sometimes the SNP is very kind of wary to use. I mean, there's occasional words that Nicola will have used in her briefing, scunnered or whatever, which would then be interpreted more strongly by Janie Godley, you know, in Glaswegian. But vernacular, not exactly Scots language, but still, even that, you know, that was quite threatening, because, you know, that propelled Janie, simply that everybody understood that and it was very colourful. That whole, your very, very tokenistic, you know, use of Scots was still enough to mm-hmm. create a lot of attachment. So if you could imagine how much more attachment there would be if Scots found its way more naturally into people's normal speaking voices. But I suspect those who speak Scots naturally, for all sorts of class reasons that you allude to, are actually now very unlikely to become elected representatives for any party.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, and it is that thing, you hit the nail right on the head, is I'm fully aware of the fact if I go into the Dundonian version of Scots, there'll be a lot of people will not be able to understand what I'm saying. And it is used in the private realm. It's used at football. It's used with my pals. It's not used in my public life. And the thing about it was that Scots was used in public life. It has been positively educated out of us over the passing centuries to become very much associated with a specific class and not with those who want to go on and better themselves. And I think the recapture of Scots as a national language that can be used in the professions and right across classes is something that, that should be pursued. And just one of my other favourites is, oh, it's Scots is a made up language. Well, I don't want to disabuse you of anything, folks, but every language is made up. You know, so every language. Is made. But anyway,
Scots' only misfortune is its proximity to English, which has accidentally become a world language. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've talked about this before, and you know, other languages right around us are just all. I was reading the Faroese, and with some Norwegian, I could understand a lot of the Faroese. Mm-hmm. Now, does that mean the Faroese, which actually is a very devolved part of Denmark, does that mean that none of them have proper languages? Just try that on them for size. Is that this just like a non-argument? There's vague attempts to discuss, you know, kind of trying to pull the languages together. It doesn't work. I mean, the bigger threat to them all is that they now use English as a common language, even in the Nordic Council of Ministers. And it'll be eventually, it'll be English that's everyone's downfall, if you see what I mean. But it will also be our problem, because since everyone in other countries is now becoming so adept at English, and if you bring in, I mean, Volodymyr Zelensky, when he does his talks, does it, and it is quite impressive that he does it in Ukrainian, because when he does it in English, it's incredibly powerful. But he's trying to communicate with his own people through all these things and puts them first. But the ability of so many people on TV and radio from Ukraine to speak very powerful English, albeit not perfectly fluent, but the bit that they can speak is utterly clear-eyed and courageous and, you know, communicates hugely, is part of what has made their primacy in the international scene. Because if they were people still stuck, as many Russians are, within their own language framework, and you'd have to say some French, for example, are quite stalwart about, you know, not having English as something that they use very often. I'm sort of really going very carefully here, because I'm not trying to suggest there's anything wrong with this. But it's only that when you can jump into English with some sort of confidence, you can actually hold the attention of the world. In a sense, more's the pity, but it's because English is an international language. I mean, eventually, we won't be able to go to places, and I find this, if even having spent three blinking years learning Norwegian, I've hardly ever been able to use it because everyone speaks better English. So if you want to get to the heart of another country, you do actually end up needing to learn their language, and soon it'll be almost impossible. It'll be almost impossible for monoglots, which is what we are, to break out of this mythological idea we have in our heads that the whole world is English-shaped, with all the kind of cultural baggage that comes with a language. And the beauty of being able to dip in and out of other languages is that for just a small period of time, you do see things from a different sort of perspective. And that soon will be something that's very difficult to do. Anyway, that's a long ramble off Scots. So peace.
But nobody's saying to Norwegians, you can't speak Norwegian. Nobody's saying to them, Ken. You know, we're no monoglots. Neither you and I are monoglots, Leslie. Mm-hmm. We're bilingual. Yep. And that's the reality.
Totally agree there. But I'm still thinking about that European kind of context of, you know, it being normal for people not to just have two languages, but five, you know, which is the world that we've left, and the world that is, you know, as soon as people are having to learn English very early in other countries, it actually makes it easier for them to pick up other languages. So they're actually increasing the range of languages they speak, and we're decreasing the range of ours. Yes. And I just wanted to make a plug, which you always do, and I always find myself caught because I never remember the things I've seen that have made an impact. But I bloomin' remember this because it was last night. An amazing film called The Velvet Queen, which is a French film about a guy who's a wildlife film and photographer, famous within France, Vincent Meunier. And he goes out to the Tibetan plateau with a guy, Sylvain Thesson, who's a kind of poet and writer, to try and track down the snow leopard, the elusive snow leopard, And a woman, Marie Amiguet, is the director who films it all completely. You'd never really realize there's another camera in the frame. She just doesn't enter into it at all. It's her film. Now, this is, I mean, you might sort of think, oh, this is just David Attenborough with, you know, Gilou from Spiral thrown in. I can't begin to tell you how amazingly emotional this whole thing and the framing of everything they see, the absolutely different attitude approach that they bring to being in landscape like this, the change that's wrought over the poet guy who's a wee bit annoying at the beginning, but finally is just making the most massive observations about the world that he sees around us, around him, one that we've lost contact with. I mean, there's a point where they're sitting surveying some yaks in silhouette. And again, if there's more beautiful pictures than this on the go at the moment, I haven't seen them. And when they're filling the whole of a cinema screen, it's utterly mind-blowing. But as the yak turns and looks for all the world like some sort of Chinese warrior in silhouette and makes your mind run through all sorts of images you've seen like this, from the human to the animal, effortlessly, which is the design and skill of the director. Sylvain is observing that the yak is the vessel of prehistory. And, you know, it really is quite spellbinding. I won't spoil it for you with the snow leopard, but it's, and the score, the musical score is, God almighty, I see that it's out as an album. It's Warren Ellis with Nick Cave doing vocals in it in just extraordinary ways. So it's in cinemas now. It's one of these ones that's in, it's like the GFT in Glasgow, the Film House in Edinburgh, the DCA in Dundee, a couple of showcase ones in Paisley and somewhere else. But I mean, God almighty, this, it's joy on a stick. It's just uplifting about the whole range of human into animal experience. And I cannot recommend it highly enough.
Wow. Well, I was going to finish with talking about leading up to next week's local elections. To hang with that. It sounds brilliant. I will take a look and see if it's still on at the DCA. Well, Mrs. Joyce and I will try and make a booking to go and see it. And on that genuinely uplifting note, we'll see you next week, chums.